From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. In this special year-end edition, Donna Martinez and I feature some of the most intriguing topics of 2018. More and more American leaders treat politics as an excuse for a performance. Yuval Levin of the Journal National Affairs explains what that means. He also discusses the impact for American government. There's more than one way to define conservative politics. The chairman of the John Locke Foundation offers his take on the topic. He borrows ideas from the late Margaret Thatcher. Private property rights play a critical role in a free society. During a speech at NC State University, a national expert explained the Constitution's role in protecting private property. And we'll delve into the history of state restrictions on medical facilities and major equipment. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
United States Senator Bernie Sanders and New York congressional candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are emerging stars in the Democratic Party. They describe themselves as socialists, but the question is, are they really socialists? Dr. Roy Cordato is senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. He writes at realclearpolicy.com that there is really no evidence they really are socialists, and he's here to explain why and what the difference is. Roy, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Donna.
Okay, so we are hearing and reading a lot of things that say the Democratic Party is moving to the left. Mm-hmm. In fact, that socialism is now part of a growing wing of the party. But you say, not really. Why not?
No, I would argue that what they are sort of unabashed welfare statists. Okay. That they fully embrace the welfare state and want to expand it to pretty much, aspect of both our economic and our private lives. But they're not socialists. Okay. Now you say, well, how is that?
Yeah.
Well, traditionally, socialism, has meant to some degree or another, the nationalization of industries, government owned, industry. Okay. The government owns the means of production. If you look at traditional definitions of socialism, that's what it says.
So you're meaning things like, say, a government owned airline.
Sure. Government owned airline.
Auto company.
Exactly.
Okay.
And in fact, if you look historically, the quote great socialist nations, right? Like North Korea and Venezuela and Cuba and the USSR, and China, nationalized industries. And not only those, but you say, well, those are dictatorships and stuff. But even Britain, after World War II, they elected a socialist government. What did they do? They started nationalizing the energy industry, the iron industry, the coal industry, and the healthcare industry. Neither Sanders nor Ortez really haven't advocated doing any of that. I mean, they're not saying, let's say, nationalize Google. Right?
I think they've talked about what they call Medicare for all.
Right.
And would that get closer to it? Then?
Well, it's interesting because people call that socialized medicine. Medicare and Medicaid are single-payer systems. They're not socialized medicine. Okay. In Britain, they have socialized medicine. The government owns the hospitals. The government owns the means of production in a socialist system. In healthcare, it would mean what Britain has. Government owns the hospitals. Doctors are government employees and so on. This is a means of – this is payment, okay? So the government is taking over the payment system, but they're not owning the means of production. The hospitals will still remain – private, quasi-private, nonprofit, whatever they are, doctors will continue to work for whoever they work for, but won't be government employees. Really, the model, if they want socialized medicine, the model is the Veterans Administration, okay, the VA hospitals. VA hospitals, socialized medicine. They are owned by the government. Doctors are employed by the government. The administration of those hospitals are government employees and so on. That is socialized medicine. What they really should be saying is we want VA for all, okay? Not Medicare for all, if they truly want socialized medicine. This is why I say they are extreme to the extent that they want government control and a very expansive, unvarnished welfare state. But that is not socialism.
What's interesting, Roy, is that you go on in the piece that you wrote for realclearpolicy.com, also available at johnlock.org, that there is a term mm-hmm. for the views of Senator Sanders and congressional candidate Ocasio-Cortez. What is it?
Well,
can you pronounce it? That's the first thing.
Exactly. Well, before I tell you what the term is, let me tell you how I came across
okay.
it. I was doing some research on the economics of fascism. And what I kept coming across is this word, which describes the nature of all the fascist economy, Mussolini in Italy, Hitler in Germany, so on. And the word is a French word. It's dirigisme, D-I-R-I-G-I-S-M-E. And dirigisme basically refers to a system where property, titles, and the means of production are in private hands, okay, in the sense that title to the companies and so on are private. But it's government making all the decisions, okay? So government directs production. Government may even set wages or at least have a strong influence on what wages would be.
And therefore, government would also predetermine almost the profit or loss of those privately owned companies.
Yes, well, because they'll be directing what they think should the direction they think the resources should go. On a very broad scale. Now, let me say, we do that, right? When we have subsidies for companies to come into North Carolina or whatever, we're doing that exact same thing, obviously on a much smaller scale. Somebody like Bernie Sanders wants to basically put that in place on a grand scale. Now, it's the approach that was used by Franco in Spain, Mussolini in Italy. But it's, as I say in the paper, it's ideologically neutral, right? It is a system where you use the power of the state to advance the goals of the state through the economy. Okay, so it doesn't matter what those goals are. They could be fascist goals or they could be extreme progressive goals, as they are with Sanders and the people who are calling themselves socialists. But the fact of the matter is, it is not a system where industry is generally nationalized.
And therefore, it's not socialism
right,
per se.
Exactly. Mussolini did not nationalize industry in Italy. Okay, he directed it and sort of made sure what got produced was what the state wanted produced and how it got produced and all that. But in general, it was not a system where they nationalized industry. And that is in large part what the so-called socialists are advocating in the Democratic Party.
Let's talk a little bit more about these emerging stars. Bernie Sanders, of course, a holdover from the 2016 presidential election. Mm-hmm. And now this new person on the scene, and she's out of New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What would be the impact, just based on your general assessment of knowing what their views are, mm-hmm. what would be the impact if we were to implement their views on the economy, for example?
Well, I mean, the impact would be dramatically less growth. I think most of their goals would not be accomplished in terms of if their goals truly are to lift to help the poor and the lower classes, I think what they would do is ultimately make everyone worse off, including the people they're trying to make better off.
It's a fascinating piece that Dr. Roy Cordato has written. You can find it at realclearpolicy.com and at johnlock.org. Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez are not socialists, is the headline, so what are they? Roy, it's a great piece, and we encourage everyone to read it. Thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Few of us would dispute the notion that Donald Trump is a very different kind of American president. But our next guest says that at least one aspect of Trump's presidency, the emphasis on performance, is a trait shared with others in our political leadership. That common trait is having a major impact on political institutions. That's the argument from Yuval Levin, editor of National Affairs and author most recently of The Fractured Republic. He joins us now to discuss this issue. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So this really is something that people who follow Donald Trump closely have noticed, is that he does, as in his previous career as a television celebrity, really seem to look at this position as a place to be a performer.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary when you watch Trump do it, because his understanding of the presidency, not really having been shaped by the kinds of experiences that really every past president in one way or another has had, either as an elected official or as a senior military officer, Trump has not been shaped by those institutions and has really been shaped by his experience as a media figure, as a celebrity, frankly, and thinks of the presidency as maybe just the biggest stage he's ever had for the performance that has been his public life. And he approaches it that way. We can see that in a lot of respects. We can see it with the way in which, for example, on Twitter, Trump will often behave as a commentator and talk about something that the Department of Justice has done that it shouldn't have done. You know, they work for him, and he might have told them to do otherwise. It's almost as though he's watching television and yelling at the television, as all of us do from time to time, except this television would actually do what he says if he put it in the right way. And so there is definitely a way in which this is a performative presidency to a greater degree than we're used to. But I would say that it's not entirely his innovation. Our politics has been moving in this direction for a while. There are a lot of ways in which President Obama saw himself also as a kind of performer first and foremost. And we also see it in our other institutions.
That was one of the points that you made in a recent presentation to the John Locke Foundation. It is not just Trump who's being the performer, but we're seeing that among members of Congress, people in the judiciary, other members of our society. How does this issue of treating these political institutions as the basis or the stage for your performance affected the institutions?
So I think that this is really something that's happening across the range of our institutions in American life, where we've gone from expecting them to be fundamentally formative, that is, giving shape to the way that people within them behave and giving even shape to the character of those people, to being more performative, to being platforms for people to perform on. You can see it in a lot of our private institutions. You can see it in the universities, where a lot of people have gone from thinking of the university as a place to be shaped, to be formed by a certain kind of liberal education, to instead be a place to perform, a place to show off their to display their moral vanity in one way or another. Journalism has moved in this direction in a lot of ways, and certainly our political institutions have. A member of Congress today will often think of the institution as a platform for himself or herself, as a way to build their national profile, to get on television and radio, as a way to become a kind of political celebrity. And oftentimes that means that they're not thinking about the institution fundamentally as a legislature, and therefore are not fighting for the prerogatives of the institution, and so we've seen Congress become weaker, are not fighting for their own role, their own place in the legislative process, but instead are just happy to use the institution as a way to raise their profile. And so a lot of what they do also is performative.
That is the voice of Yuval Levin, editor of National Affairs, author most recently of the book The Fractured Republic. I guess there is some irony about political observers talking about this performance.
Exactly. Right. They're performing for us, after all. Yeah.
on a radio show. But how has this transformation into politics as sort of performance art had negative consequences in your view?
Well, the basic trouble is that in doing this other thing, they're not doing their basic work. They're not playing the part that the Constitution expects them to play. And so the Congress has a very important role in our system, the primary role, the foremost and central role. And it is expected to be a very strong legislature when its members are expected to be motivated by an ambition that is channeled through their institution. When that doesn't happen, Congress doesn't do its job, and Congress doesn't insist on its prerogatives, doesn't pass legislation that compels the other branches of government in the way that it is expected to by the framers of the Constitution. And that's part of why we've seen the Congress become weaker over time and leave a lot of important judgments and decisions to the executive branch on the one hand and the administrative state and to the judiciary on the other hand. Conservatives like me are in the habit of complaining about executive overreach and judicial overreach, and we're right to complain. But a lot of this is a function of congressional underreach and of an unwillingness on the part of the Congress to do its fundamental job, which has to do with the fact that members are actually really doing a different job. You find the same thing happening with judges. Read a Supreme Court opinion by Justice Kennedy now, and you're just watching somebody perform. If someone's putting on a show for you to prove to you just how moral he is, what he's not doing is what a judge ought to do, which is interpret the law and the Constitution. We think of this as a kind of judicial activism, judicial overreach, but it is also a performance and suffers from the same problems that we find in the Congress and in the presidency.
How much of this is a function of the fact that we have much larger and more available stage space?
Yeah, absolutely. It's true. There are more places to perform. There are more ways to become a celebrity. But what that's meant is that a lot of our other institutions have been transformed themselves into stages, from the judicial bench to the floor of the Congress. We've seen these places transform into performative spaces, no doubt because there are many more ways to get in front of the public now.
What do we do about it?
Well, I think what's required is some recovery of institutional ambition. And frankly, the only way for that to happen is for the people who occupy these positions to want it to happen. And that means making the case for why a member of Congress ought to see a stronger Congress as serving his own ambition and political interests, why a president ought to see being the chief executive as the way to become an important figure in American life and American history, why a judge should see actually interpreting the law as the way to become important and play the role they're supposed to play. That takes argument, and so really it takes this kind of conversation.
Is one of the problems the fact that no one has really paid a price for being one of these performers? We rarely see people getting voted out because they seem to be playing more to the cameras than doing their job.
Yeah, no question about it. I think that some of this argument that has to be made to voters. Voters certainly are unhappy with Congress, right? The approval rating of Congress, I mean, it doesn't reach much beyond immediate relatives of members and staff, but nonetheless, voters don't respond to that dissatisfaction by insisting that members return to an idea of what a member of Congress is supposed to do that's better enshrined in the Constitution. Certainly the president benefits from being a performer, or at least he thinks he does. Every president, every recent president has thought so. And so, again, the political pressure has to be there to compel our politicians to do what they're required to do by our system of government. And that calls for better citizens, and that's no small challenge, obviously.
given what you know about the people involved in the process, do you see anyone out there who is willing to move away from this politics as performance art sort of setting?
Well, I think it would take institutionalists. And so there are some in our various branches of government. This president is a performer, and that's not going to change. I think the question is whether the incentives will be there for someone to run after him by making a case that the president has a particular job and how to do that particular job.
It's a fascinating topic. One person who is going to continue to monitor this issue very closely is Yuval Levin, editor of National Affairs, author most recently of the book The Fractured Republic. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. What does it mean to engage in conservative politics? Of course, there's more than one definition. John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood has one. It's fairly simple. He shared it recently during a speech for the Leadership Institute in Washington, D.C.
I think the simplest way to describe that is the way Margaret Thatcher once did when she simply said, "The facts of life are conservative." That's it. The point being, conservatism, and if you think about it, it's an alliance. It's an amalgam of some very different strains of thought, from traditionalists to libertarians to hawks. What binds this sort of unwieldy coalition together is an acceptance of reality as it is. Now, that is not to say that one accepts the current state of affairs as, well, this is the best we can do. That's not at all what this means. As Francis Bacon said, nature, in order to be commanded, must be obeyed. In other words, if you want to make a change in human affairs, you need to start with something that is unchangeable, which is human nature. And if you think about it, all of the strands of conservative thought take as their starting point something that is unchanging. If you're a traditionalist or a social conservative, you believe there are certain virtues or traditions or institutions that have proven themselves over time to be valuable and enduring and supportive of human flourishing. If you're a libertarian, a free marketeer, you believe there are certain inescapable facts of life. Scarcity, desire to make something better for yourselves and your family, which we call self-interest, but is actually not just about the self, it's about something broader than the self. And these are inescapable realities. You may want things to be the same that they were 20 years ago, but technology's changed, people have gone on and done something different, and you can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's unchangeable. And similarly, if you're a foreign policy conservative, if you're a hawk, you recognize that we can dream all day long and make up songs about imagine no, you know, no national borders and no heaven and no hell and things like that. But the reality is that the world is populated by people who want to steal you and knock you over the head and take your stuff. And so you better protect yourself. It's just part of reality. So my definition of conservative politics is the practice of the facts of life, applying them to reality.
That's John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood speaking recently in Washington, D.C. Hood defined the term conservative politics during a presentation for the Leadership Institute. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Private property rights are critical to a free society. Why? Well, our next guest will help us discuss that topic. Ilya Soman is professor of law at George Mason University, and he recently discussed property rights and the Constitution during a speech at North Carolina State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So before we get into some current controversies involving property rights, just remind us, why is this such an important issue that people ought to be paying attention to?
For several reasons. First, property rights are an important element of freedom more generally. Without the right to private property, it's hard to have a free society, virtually impossible. It's hard for individual citizens to exercise their autonomy. In addition, development economists have increasingly found that secure property rights are essential to economic growth, particularly in poor nations and also for poor people within our own society as well.
What does our Constitution say about property rights and protecting them?
The Constitution has several provisions protecting property rights. Perhaps the most important is the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment, which says that the government can only take private property for public use and also must pay just compensation. In addition, there is the Due Process Clauses of the Fifth and the 14th Amendment, which ensure that government cannot take away your property without due process of law. Obviously, each of these provisions and their meaning has been the subject of much controversy, but all, I think, properly interpreted do provide significant protection for property rights. There are also other provisions that protect them indirectly.
Has support for private property rights waxed and waned at all over the years?
Definitely. So certainly in the early Republic, protecting property rights was one of the main objectives of the federal Constitution, was one of the reasons why the founders set it up in the first place. Also, while there was a lot of debate over property rights in the 19th century and over the meaning of these provisions that I've just described, still generally speaking, the dominant view in state and federal courts and also among legal experts of that time was that there should be strong judicial protection for property rights. That began to wane in the progressive era in the late 19th and early 20th century. And at least with respect to judicial review by federal courts, it collapsed almost entirely after the New Deal era, beginning from the 1930s to roughly the 40s and into the 50s. There has been somewhat of a revival over the last 30 years, though I think that revival falls short in some places and it's still highly controversial. But overall, there has been a challenge to what used to be the post-New Deal orthodoxy, which said that the judiciary should provide little or no protection for property rights.
That is the voice of Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University. He has discussed property rights in the Constitution during a speech at North Carolina State University. Also, the author of The Grasping Hand, Kelo versus City of New London and the Limits of Eminent Domain. And also, if you are interested in learning a little bit more about eminent domain, one of the people involved in the book Eminent Domain, A Comparative Perspective. Now, we're talking generally about property rights, but there are also some current controversies involving property rights. What's one of the main ones you're watching right now?
One big one that perhaps many of you have seen in the news is going on in Houston right now. As I think most people know, large parts of Houston were flooded during Hurricane Harvey. But some parts that were spared by the hurricane itself were deliberately flooded by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on the theory that doing so might avoid still greater flooding that might have happened if certain water reservoirs overflowed. But obviously, these people who had their homes or businesses flooded at the behest of the government, deliberately flooded, they're pretty angry about it, is understandable. And they filed large numbers of lawsuits in federal courts, I think dozens of them, arguing that this was a taking of their property by the government and therefore deserves compensation. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected the Obama administration's somewhat extreme argument that deliberate flooding of property by the government can never be a taking, but the court was somewhat vague under the question of, well, exactly when is deliberate flooding a taking and when it's not. And unfortunately, in the present litigation, the federal government in the Trump administration has taken the position that if the flooding happened only one time, it's never a taking, no compensation. Critics call this the one free flood rule. I think that this doesn't make much sense, and that if the government inflicts severe damage on your property by flooding it, it should be considered a taking. They may have a good reason for doing it, just as they may have a good reason sometimes for taking your property to build a road or some other public facility. But the Constitution, I think, still requires the payment of compensation in such cases. So I think these Houston cases are not only important in themselves, because there are large numbers of people involved, but they will likely set important precedents for future situations like this, because sadly, this probably won't be the last time that the government deliberately floods property.
You're also watching, I understand, another piece of property rights information that deals with the Trump administration and specifically Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Yes. This relates to the practice of asset forfeiture, which is a technical legal term for a kind of legalized plunder that the government engages in. Basically, if you are investigated or suspected of a crime in many states and also in some federal government programs, the government can seize your property and keep it, even if you yourself are never charged with a crime, much less convicted of one. They can do this on the theory that your property was somehow involved in the crime. maybe drug dealers used your car to do a drug sale or something of the sort. And in many states, the seizure can occur in such a way that the owners have very little opportunity to challenge it. The government may hold on to it for many months before they can challenge the seizure. And even when you can, the procedures often are stacked against the owners. There have been reform efforts in many states to try to fix this problem. In recent years, increasingly in those states where reform efforts have cracked down on this practice, both by limiting seizures and also limiting the ability of law enforcement agencies to keep the plunder for themselves, this has been gotten around by the state law enforcement working with the federal government in what is known as equitable sharing. So in technical lingo, the federal government adopts the seizure, and then they distribute some of the loot back to the state law enforcement agencies, thus getting around state law prohibitions. This program was curbed late in the Obama administration, but Attorney General Jeff Sessions reinstated it fully over the summer. In Congress, there are efforts to abolish the Sessions policy. Two amendments that would do this nearly unanimously passed the House of Representatives. They have broad bipartisan support. Both left and right have reasons to be angry about this. The issue is now before the Senate, where it also has some bipartisan support, but obviously it's easier to obstruct bills in the Senate in various ways than in the House. So people interested in this issue, I think, will be watching to see what happens in the Senate.
If people hear the words property rights and their eyes start to glaze over, what would you say to them about, no, you need to pay attention to this. This is important.
Property rights structure our lives in many different ways. Whenever you buy a house, whenever you engage in many kinds of transactions, property rights are involved. Moreover, property rights are essential to economic development. That's one of the major functions of major findings of modern development economics. In cities where property rights are severely restricted, it destroys a great deal of wealth, both in this country and abroad, particularly for the poor.
Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Expanded access to doctors and hospitals at a lower cost. Now, that is the goal that most folks can agree on, regardless of ideology, when it comes to reforming our healthcare system. Our next guest says that a good first step toward meeting that goal is to take a very serious look at a North Carolina law that works against the expansion of options and against bringing down costs. Jordan Roberts is the new healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now. Jordan, welcome to the show. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In a nutshell, explain to us what we're talking about here. This law is technically called Certificate of Need. But what does it do? What's it require?
That's right. So Certificate of Need laws were put in place a couple decades ago in an attempt to lower healthcare costs by limiting the supply of healthcare services that are provided. So what ends up happening is if you are a physician that wants to provide a new service or a existing facility that wants to expand, you would need to go to a state planning board and prove to them that there is a need to provide this service at levels higher than what is already being provided. You'd submit an application, and the state would look at their data to see if they project a similar need, and then they would either grant access or deny access. So what ends up happening is you have government bureaucrats that are really deciding who can enter into the healthcare market, and that really has some adverse effect for a lot of consumers and providers.
What you found in your research, Jordan, and it's really interesting because you've been writing about this, and folks can read your blog in the locker room at johnlock.org. You found that North Carolina was by far not the first state to do this, and certainly
That's right.
Has been going on for decades and decades and decades. Tell us about the history of con laws.
So what I found was that these certificate of need laws really came about in the as far back as the 1800s, and they were used to regulate businesses and industries like the railroads, public utilities, things like this. And they were implemented to try to reduce wasteful duplication of services back then and what people referred to as ruinous or bad competition. So to take the railroads, for example, what would happen is there were laws in place that would restrict the railroads from charging market rates to their customers. And so in an attempt to keep the railroad companies that were already in existence profitable, the state would use certificate of need laws in an attempt to insulate those current railroad providers from any type of competition. So from the earliest onset, it was really an example of cronyism. And so there was a lot of progressive ideas during the 1800s at this time, and so it wasn't uncommon for the state legislatures to try to regulate business to this extent.
Now, when you fast forward into the 1900s, then North Carolina, among a number of states that still have certificate of need laws in place, and I think, Jordan, when people listening to us might be thinking, you know what, it kind of sounds like the motives of the people who support this kind of thing might be good. They're trying to, quote, protect people from high prices, et cetera. But as you mentioned earlier, there's really a lot of negative consequences that come with this that people may not realize. Let's talk about some of those that you've been writing about. You're talking about reducing the access to health care. How does a con law do that?
So by limiting the amount of competition that you can or that a incumbent hospital provider can have, it really just limits the number of choices that patients have to go and get care. So what we see is that states that have certificate of need laws, they have much fewer rural health care, rural hospitals and other health care substitutes like this in these types of counties. And the patients that are in states with certificate of need laws have to travel much further to get the same types of procedures done that other similar citizens would have to travel in states without certificate of need laws. And there's also, you know, the thought that this really raises costs. So a lot of the procedures that can be done in hospitals that are protected by certificate of need laws from any type of competitors charge a lot more for, let's say, an ACL surgery. And so if you were to get this ACL surgery done in a state without a certificate of need law, you might have a lot more options to get it at a lot lower cost facilities. So these laws, really what they do is they protect incumbent providers by not allowing any competitors to come into the market and charge lower rates for patients.
Yeah, that's a really important point, because a few minutes ago when you described what the original intent of a con law is, one of the things was to reduce the so-called oversupply. But yet what really happens in the real world is, as you said, there are some people who may live in an outlying county. They may have to drive miles upon miles to try to actually access a service. It seems like that because that's the reality of it, that you would have state lawmakers who would say, wait a second, maybe we're off track here with this con law.
Right. So the intent is to bring down costs by limiting the supply. The thought is that if you reduce the amount of unused equipment or unused beds, then it would bring down overhead costs across the board. But when you limit the supply, you really limit the competition and the options that consumers have. And these incumbent providers can use this market power to really charge whatever rates they want and to really just dictate who can come in and compete with them to get access to the same patient population.
And talk about real-world impact, not only on patients, but recently here at the John Locke Foundation, we hosted a Forsyth County doctor who is in the process of trying to fight this certificate of need law as it relates to his practice, and he's trying to be able to offer MRI services to his patients. Give us kind of the Reader's Digest version of what his issue is and how it's impacting his patients.
Right. So the case you're referring to is Dr. Singh, and he opened an imaging center in Forsyth County, and he was able to acquire most of the equipment to provide all the services he wanted to, except an MRI machine. The state regulates MRI machine usage, and Forsyth County hospitals had all the certificate of needs for this. So he applied to the state to say that he wanted to offer lower rates to patients in Forsyth County, and the state said no, there is no need for this, even though the patients, as Dr. Singh will tell you, there's plenty of them coming up to him saying that we can't afford the MRI and other imaging services that hospitals are charging, and we need these services done. So Dr. Singh went out, tried to provide this service, and the state simply said no, there's no need for this.
This is so curious that someone sitting in Raleigh, and no disrespect meant to people who are doing their job as part of a state agency, they're following the rules that are in place and the law that's in place, but it just seems really quizzical that they would think that they could actually assess the so-called need when you've got a doctor right there who's
right.
saying, my patients need this service and I want to offer it. Why won't you let me do that?
Right. So, you know, it really is quite something to think about that the state planning boards in Raleigh think that they know the needs of the patients at community level better. And so I just think that that's not the way that this type of regulation should go forward and what it should do.
We've been talking with Jordan Roberts. He is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He's written a really fascinating piece about this law we've been discussing. It's called the North Carolina Certificate of Need Law. Jordan, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.